How do I know what I think until I see what I say?
The Green Notebook, carried by military leaders around the world. Within those pages are sweat, tears, triumphs, and the hard-won lessons of life. Lessons worth sharing. Each week, the team dives into the notebooks of military leaders, business professionals, authors, athletes and coaches, and entertainers to share lessons and help you lead with the best version of yourself.
Today's episode is sponsored by Adaton. I got to know Adaton's co-founders, James and JJ, several years ago. They are former Army NCOs who have years of experience in the tech industry. They have firsthand knowledge of what it's like to serve and truly listen to service members in order to understand the critical challenges they face today. Adaton understands that most military jobs are not performed behind a computer desk. They kept hearing leaders ask for a better way to support and care for their people, regardless of their location. This led to the development of Adaton's flagship software product, Muster, spelled M-U-S-T-R. Muster is like a digital knife hand. It streamlines the daily task of ensuring people accountability, resilience, and automation of data calls that currently rely on phone trees, text messages, and manual data entries into Excel spreadsheets. Muster revolutionizes the way leaders take care of their people, which is their primary responsibility, not sitting for hours in front of their computers. Many branches of the military are now utilizing Muster. The time is right for leaders to get involved and see the impact it can have. If you're interested in making an impact or learning about what other units are doing, reach out to Adaton. For a limited time only, listeners of the From the Green Notebook podcast can try out Muster for free. Visit adaton.io/FTGN to get started. That's adaton.io/FTGN. Welcome to another episode of From the Green Notebook. I'm your host, Joe Byerly, and this week we're diving into the notebook of the Sergeant Major of the Army, Sergeant Major Mike Weimer. Before you listen to the interview, I want you to know that I could have spent hours talking to him and going down some really fun and interesting rabbit holes. But our time was limited and there were a lot of topics I wanted to cover. So up front, please forgive me if you feel like we didn't spend enough time on something that interested you. But in this conversation, Sergeant Major Weimer shares how the military is a family business for him, much like it is for many of you, and how this played a significant role in his decision to serve. We also delve into his personal journey of growth throughout his career, exploring how family, self-reflection, and mentors have positively influenced his trajectory. We even dedicated some time to discussing the importance of engaging in difficult conversations and the value of approaching them with empathy. Now, Sergeant Major and I had worked together in the past, but this was the first time I had the opportunity to just talk with him about his life and got to learn some great wisdom about leadership in the process. So, grab your green notebooks and please welcome to the show the Sergeant Major of the Army, Sergeant Major Michael Weimer.
Hey, Joe. It's great to be here. Sorry it's taking me so long, but you got me. Here I am.
This interview has been a while in the making, and you know, it's a lot of the people who come on this podcast, I'm able to do a lot of research on them, and you were a lot harder to research. So we're just going to go with a couple nuggets I have. So the first is that you grew up in a military family, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm a true blue Army brat, third generation, actually. So yeah, I got a lot of time overseas as a kid. And I like to say I have a very traditional Army brat life, you know, as a dependent, lots of PCSing, lots of overseas time from the 70s and 80s. But then I have a very untraditional or unorthodox actual time in uniform.
You know, my son right now is 13. And my daughter is, she just turned 6 a few days ago. And I'm always trying to think about my career and the experiences I'm giving them through their eyes. So what As you look back on your childhood, like, what are some of the things that stood out that you're like, this is what I got to do?
Wow. I would say in my house, growing up as an Army brat, there was always a sense of service. Again, I'm a little older than the average individual at this point in my career, but that was, the war was going on back then. And so we were a very focused nation. And so I can still remember my mom and dad being in sync with, you know, why we were living in Europe in the 70s and then twice in the 80s. And when Reforger was going on and all of Europe was activated with NATO and just that unity. I don't know. It was really exciting to watch. And as a dependent, you were part of that because dependents, we actually planned, you know, and rehearsed evacuations. And so the Army family, and I'm sure it was similar for my joint teammates at that time, was very integrated in the mission. And I felt that and that purpose, I think I've always been attracted to it.
You know, something else too, in addition to purpose, is the family aspect of it as well. Is like you're serving alongside men and women who, you know, become like brothers and sisters as you train together, as you grow together. And, you know, again, I watch my kids. They're playing with other kids whose parents are going through the same thing. Yeah. I remember when I lived back in the Fort Liberty area in our neighborhood, you know, every few months, somebody's mom or dad was gone. And yep. The one thing I remember is that every kid there understood that and knew what it was like when that happened. And they just seemed to kind of, hey, so-and-so's, you know, dad's leaving. Is that kind of a similar experience for you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, the military family journey, it's a bit of a mungadai. It's a bit of a crucible. When it's done correctly, it can be one of the most edifying, you know, experiences you've ever had in your life, which is why I think you see so many kids. I think we're up to, I think it's like 82, 83% of people serving right now come from somebody in their family having been in the service, right? So, but I think it's that shared experience. We talk about it in a sense of like, how do you build cohesive teams? It's shared hardship. It's that teamwork. It's that dynamic of solving a hard problem that you got to have a little sweat, sometimes a little tears, and you come out of the other end and you solved it together. Well, that's a bit of the Army family, the dynamic that you kind of cut your teeth on as a kid. In this case, you know, our children. I know definitely that's my daughter's journeys.
I want to get into that too, because now you have, what, fourth generations?
Yeah.
They're heading in. But for you, what was, do you remember, like, because I think you joined in 93.
Yep.
Was there like a, was it younger, like when you were like 12, 13, this is what I'm going to do?
Yeah.
Or was it a decision that came a little bit later?
No, I knew if my mother was on this podcast right now, she would go, oh no, we knew. She'd probably tell you she knew when I was 10, 11, or 12 years old. But I would say by the time I was a freshman in high school, there was no doubt in her mind that, you know, somehow, some way I was going to be a Green Beret. The journey started that early in my life. I mean, I was this back before phones and television. I read. I mean, I went to the library and I read books, everything I could get my hands on in Southeast Asia from the 50s to the 70s. I studied the Vietnam War and the MacV Sog era. And I just felt that that's what I wanted to do. That's what I was called to do. And I drove my mother crazy with it. My dad hoped it would go away. I would outgrow it. And yeah, I think it's safe to say it. That never happened.
It's funny that you say that, you know, the conversations I have with my son, because, you know, thankfully he doesn't have my genes. I mean, he's got some of them, but like I'm 5'7". You know, my father-in-law is like 6'2", 6'3". And so my son's like, I'm either A, going to play in the NFL one day, or if that doesn't work out, daddy's like, I'm going to just follow your footsteps and join the Army. And I keep trying to talk
about it. Pretty good backup plan. No, that's a good backup. I'd be good if you flip-flop those.
Yeah.
Put the Army first and the backup was the NFL.
It wouldn't surprise me. But yeah, and I see it again with all of his friends as they talk, because again, they're growing up in a community of shared hardship, you know, very relatable to each other. And then those experiences. So for your daughter, did you encourage her to go in, or is it something that she said, Dad, this is what I'm doing?
I was pretty hands off. You know, there's no manual for your first child. And so, you know, like Ainsley, my oldest daughter, she wants to be a psychologist. So she's She's in her fourth year studying that, but she's actually talked about wanting to really specialize on military kids and military families. And I think that's because of part of her journey. And she's a GWAP baby, and that girl knows hardship and what service cost at home and amongst, you know, the teammates, that close-knit teammate crew family that, you know, you end up doing all the memorials for. And so she knows it. She's lived that visceral emotional roller coaster. And so I encouraged, yes, but never pushed. And then Zoe, our youngest, that's intrinsic motivation that she's had. And we just, as parents that kind of figure it out on your second child, you're like, oh, I'm just going to slightly encourage and not push. And then I'm going to introduce you to people that, you know, can encourage also. And in her case, wanting to be an officer, I just put really great commanders in front of her and let them talk to her and got out of the way.
That's amazing. Like, and you know, the more people I meet, more soldiers I talk to and ask why you joined, I would say that 60 to 70% of my own all have joined because they had a mother or a father who served.
Yeah.
And you know, they kind of felt like they wanted to follow in the family business.
And it's a hard business too. So we must be doing something right. Because nothing's given to you. You're going to earn, the opportunities are endless, right? We talk about the opportunities that the military offer you. And that is a true statement. It's like, I always tell everybody, it's like the Matrix for anybody that remembers that movie, all three or four of them. It's like that crazy hallway with all the doors. That's like the opportunities. They're endless, but you still got to go open the door and earn it. Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when your kids do that, you know, they're signing up for like, and you and I know, but you're like, oof, okay, you chose the path least traveled because you're going to earn all the successes that are to come in your future.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I want to get in a little bit of your career. So sure. 93, you've been in for a hot minute. You've seen some stuff. And I'm just curious of like how your outlook to your career, because, you know, a lot of I'll talk to, you know, newer officers, newer soldiers, and, you know, the fact that I've done 20 as of like next week.
Wow.
Is one of those things that, you know, they're like, I don't understand.
Yeah.
I can't imagine, you know, 20 years.
Yeah.
I know for me, I've lived my entire career in what I say like 6 month increments from like summer leave to winter leave, from winter leave to summer leave, or from deployment to deployment.
Yeah.
I never kind of looked up. How did you approach yours?
Yeah, I'd say very, very similarly, until I had a family and my kids got older, and then I was forced, you know, I was forced to look out at the, you know, the 1,000-meter target, right? Instead of the 25-meter target, as we would say in our lingo, because I really was deployment to deployment for, oh, mercy, I don't know, a dozen plus years. Like my wife could tell you exactly, right? Because she's the one that carried that rucksack that entire time. But I really did, as a matter of fact, I coach and encourage to live in the moment, lead in the moment. Don't think about what's next because you'll take your eye off the ball. Like you're responsible for people right now. You have a mission. You're responsible. It's a heavy weight, especially as you know, each increase in responsibility, each rank you would call it. And so the moment you start thinking about what's next, I think you shift from focusing on the team and the responsibility and the mission, and you end up a little bit focusing on self. And I can tell you, I've got some ebbs and flows where I have focused a little too much on self, and it's natural, right? We're human beings. You don't ever perfect this. It's a journey. But every time I focused on self a little, and sometimes I was coached, you need to start thinking about this, then you need to do this. And that's part of the professional development model, right? It's not bad. It's not an unhealthy thing. But as soon as that becomes the thing, then you're not leading in the moment and you're not the best version of you.
I love that you said that. And I think when I think about it now, and I think as you know, somebody who's in their early 40s, you know, there's a lot more maturity behind it. Mm. But like when you're focused in the moment, you're able to take everything from it. So for example, if you're a more junior person, like it's okay to ask a ton of questions. Like everyone's going to think you're dumb already.
Yeah.
So you can learn as much as you can about whatever topic it is about your job.
Yeah.
You know, you can just absorb all that. And the more you can absorb in those moments, it will pay off down the road. Like the down the road will take care of itself.
Yeah.
But it's making the most. And then even the investment in the people aspect of it.
Yeah.
There's so much great talent in our organizations, and just taking a moment to listen and kind of understand people, you can help people through so many problems. And it's cool to watch yourself grow, but I think it's even cooler to watch the people around you grow. Again, as a result of staying in the job.
So much.
Yeah, yeah.
The reward seeing you be able to help somebody else be successful, even it's even a greater reward when they're more successful than you were. Like, they're better than you. Like, I love the fact that there are people coming behind me that I wish I would have had. I used to say, you know, I got an ounce of talent in my pinky compared to some of these people. This generation coming up, it's crazy. But when you're young, you're speaking to the maturity piece over time, right? Because there's just some redemptive history that has to take place before you just have the epiphany that it's not about you. It's all about the legacy you leave behind and the generation you're building. And trust me, I have a picture of Staff Sergeant Weimer. My office knows where it is. It's sitting right underneath the glass on my desk in my new office that I still, some days I come in there and can't believe it's my office. And it's Staff Sergeant Weimer. I'm here to tell you, man, there are a lot of people that invested in that youngster who was cocky, knew it all, trying to get, you know, just what's the next badge? What's the next thing? I can't see the trees from the forest to save my life. I was going to be argumentative. You know, I thought I knew what right looked like. And again, that wasn't Mike Weimer as a E7, E8, E9. And then, you know, it's a bit of a journey. And that's why the leader that I give full credit to, a bunch of people that like snatched me up and reined me in, right? And I do prefer people I have to rein in vice coddle in the warfighting business, but you're going to have to be able to lead both. And so you need to know how to handle that. But believe me, you need some humility, and you need to remember your perspective today is not the perspective you had when you were 25. It's just not.
Yeah. Like, why couldn't we have had this conversation with ourselves about 2 decades ago? I feel like the last 20 years for both of us would have been way easier.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's why I love the fact that right now I can give a whole bunch of those people a shout out and say, thank you. You invested in me. You took a risk on me. You saw something in me. You didn't ignore it. You acted on it. You didn't quit on me. You didn't give up on me. I mean, I think sometimes we attain a certain position that's, you know, oh, you're so successful. And then we really forget that, you know, this is a journey to, you know, and that success is, I temper that. You know, you can say, hey, don't get too big for your britches. We still do windows and take out the trash. But if you don't actually wash the window or take the trash out, then you're not actually doing what you say you're still doing. So there's a balance to it. That's why conversations like this are great. This ensures you stay humble. And that's really key to being an empathetic, you know, servant leader.
As you look back on your career, what were some of the greatest challenges you faced that maybe in the moment you were like, I don't know if I'm going to make it through this. Mm. And then you look back now and you're like, man, that wasn't as hard as I thought it was going to be.
Probably myself. I mean, I was just so cocky and knew it all and had all the answers that, you know, I would receive good wisdom and I would ignore it because I didn't like it. I mean, it's no different than generation today. They, you know, I did the same thing. Seek out counseling and wisdom from somebody that's going to give me the answer I want, right? It's the same thing today. It's just we go to the internet and our phones for it. Back then, I had to actually interact with human beings. And I look back now and I'm like, oh my word, you had so many people. You could have expedited this, you know, 5 years earlier if you would have just listened to insert so-and-so who encouraged you to go do X, Y, and Z instead of A, B, C, and D. And so probably myself, which is why I'm really big on promoting, you know, the mentorship model early. You know, like, I'll worry about that mentorship when I'm, you know, and when I'm an 05 or an E8, maybe E9 when I get to the academy. And I'm like, whoa, you've missed 10, 15 years of potential development. Don't shortchange yourself like that. But that was me. That was me is like, I don't like what you're saying. So you have nothing to offer. So probably me on the first one. The second one I would say is when I attained certain level of leadership while simultaneously having a family, because I didn't get married till I was 29 years old. And then, of course, I got married like 10 days later, we were at war. And so I was in parallel these things were happening at the same time. And needless to say, you can probably imagine in the first 10 years of that, which one was sacrificing, right? Which one was here and which one was here. And then so you're, you know, all of a sudden your kids are, you know, they're 9, 10, 11. And all of a sudden you realize, whoa, I've got to shift. I got to balance this a little bit more. You can't make up for lost time. You even have more responsibility at work. I used to think work was really hard until probably about 10 years of trying to lead well at home as a family. Then I really knew what hard leadership was. And so I kind of chuckle now when I hear that, you know, the single 04 or single E8 that, and I'm like, you know, not in a belittling way, but internally I just kind of chuckle and I go, I remember when I thought that was really hard.
Yeah. Did you find yourself when you started doing that rebalancing, that personal rebalancing, did you find that you were having to make what you believe to be counterintuitive decisions when it came to like,
oh, yeah,
do I stay later at work?
Oh yeah.
Or do I like just say, hey, it's this time, I'm leaving now, I'm going to this game, I'm going to this, you know, recital, I'm going to this event, I'm going to go have dinner, and then just go do it like unapologetically. And the reason why I'm asking the question is because I was, for the longest time, I was like, it'll be fine. I'll stay a little bit later. Maybe I'll, you know, sacrifice this, I'll sacrifice that. But now I'm like pretty unapologetic about it. I'm putting, you know, my daughter's holiday show on the calendar and I'm going to be there for it.
Yeah. We've grown a lot in this space. I've seen it, you know, I go back to my Army brat days all the way to, you know, it's hard to believe it's 2024. And this conversation alone has evolved so much in a healthy way, because it was a struggle. And if my wife was here, she'd be holding me accountable. I struggled a lot with this. When you're deploying every 9 months or on alert in between, and you feel obligated to always be ready, there is no off season, and you know people's lives are at stake all the time. I mean, it is heavy, right? It's the, you know, the proverbial rucksack. You never get to take it off. That was really hard to say, you know, it was always going a little bit earlier and stay a little bit later. And then I have the weekend. Well, then you end up working the weekend. And so your plan just completely, the wheels come off the bus with your plan. And then you can't make up for lost time. You can only be in the moment during the event. And so that was the transition for me. It was increased intentionality, because if I'm not doing it as a leader, nobody else is going to do it. So that was step one. And then step two was the guilt. Like, I had to learn how to get rid of the guilt. And when you lose people in combat, it's a heavy guilt. There's a guilt of like, we're not ready enough. We got to do more. We're not ready enough. It's my responsibility. It's a heavy guilt to carry. A little bit different right now with some of the, you know, just the current environment we have with what we're asking the military to do. And that's okay. War and combat are an ugly thing for those that haven't experienced it yet. Careful what you wish for, but I had to shed that guilt. And then I go back to what you said earlier. Then I realized people were watching me. One, I enjoyed the recital, or I enjoyed the soccer game when my girls got really competitive in sports in junior high and high school. And then I saw the freedom it gave my subordinates to start increasing that intentionality earlier when I was being a knucklehead. And so it was kind of the sum of those three things that really kind of, and it's a cultural thing, right? Not to take us down a giant cultural rabbit hole, but it really is when you think about it. And that's the freedom inside that environment to not feel guilty, to model what right looks like. And then you can measure, like, are my subordinates doing this?
That's such a great point you make, is giving, our example gives other people permission to do the right thing.
Huge.
Because it's one of the things, like reading a lot and even doing the show, there was a book I read called Herding Tigers by Todd Henry. And he was one of my guests. And he talks about this concept of ghost rules. And he says that every organization has them. And it's the rules that people think they need to abide by. And I know that there's thousands of them in the military. You know, one of those is like, hey, you have to work late just to work late. Not necessarily to accomplish a mission or prepare for the next mission. You just got to hang out. And so that's one of the things that I've learned with maturity, is when you're explicit And when you have your own personal example, it helps to void out some of those ghost rules that plague us.
Well, those are real. That's real. I mean, you've heard it. You're like, yeah, sure. There's nothing illegal or moral or unethical with that decision, but good luck with that. Let me know how that works out for you. I mean, we know it. I mean, culturally, that's the paraculture underneath the culture we say, right? There's the public culture, and then the paraculture is like what's happening in the background. I think the freedom came when I realized, wait a minute, I'm the person now. Like, I am the person that sets that either crushes the ghost culture or supports it, right? Because if I'm living by that ghost culture, then wait a minute, now I'm the problem, right? Because I could no longer point up to somebody else being the problem. And that's where I think that freedom came. And frankly, the first time I realized that I was paired up with a phenomenal officer as a team, and that is powerful. I love that model. The command team is, I'll miss that when I get out. It's, you know, the Chinese would love to have that. That was when I realized, wait a minute, we set this. We set this, and then we hold people accountable. That's when I realized, okay, that's unhealthy. Well, now do something about it. And we were able to do something about it.
As a unit leader, you want your team to look great and feel united, but you don't have the time to deal with the hassle of designing custom apparel, collecting money, making the roster of sizes, and then figuring out where to store everything once it finally comes in. You also don't want to deal with the stress of worrying about the quality of the gear or that it actually arrives on time. Meet X-Ray, a veteran-owned apparel brand elevating the custom gear experience. X-Ray provides free design services and creates dedicated web stores for units. This allows individual members to place and pay for their own orders at any time with the items being delivered directly to their homes. There are no minimum order sizes or upfront costs involved, and X-Ray produces elevated performance apparel and casual gear on demand right here in America. This means that they are never out of stock and can make any design you can imagine. X-Ray's performance line features designs that are permanently dyed into the fabric. As a result, your unit logos will never fade, crack, or peel. With X-Ray, you and your team will have apparel that meets your high standards, whether you're doing PT, working out in the gym, relaxing at home, or anywhere else you choose to wear it. With a simple form submission, you can open your own unit store and have a hassle-free product line your team members will be proud to wear. Units who launch custom stores with X-Ray automatically get 20% off MSRP, and volume discounts are available for groups that prefer to order larger quantities all at once. X-Ray is made here, made to last, and made by veterans. Launch a custom design with X-Ray today at www.xray.cc. That's EXRAY.cc. You mentioned it, so now I'm going to ask. The team of the, you know, commander, command sergeant, major, commander, first sergeant, platoon leader, platoon sergeant, mm-hmm. section OIC, NCOIC. Mm-hmm. What have you learned about making that relationship work from your side of the house?
Well, I mean, I've said it enough, so, you know, it'd be unfair if I didn't say it here. The more senior a commander becomes, the more established they become and confident in their way of leadership. That's the Army structure, right? All authority lies within them. They are the commander. He or she is the commander, right? The non-commissioned officer is not the commander, and it's actually part of what makes us special. We complement the commander. And so I tell everybody, I was like, you know, actually say this in any POI, but the non-commissioned officer is the one that has to be the chameleon. I've worked for many a commander, and they come in themselves, and the sergeant major in this case, or the first sergeant, you have to adjust to the commander's style. And that's the human domain. This is where EQ comes in. And how do I learn to communicate with this person? Because everybody's watching us solve problems together as a team. And so the ones I've seen struggle are the commanders that don't realize how important that relationship is. So there's no like, let's figure this out quickly. And then the NCO that struggles to fit in. Why did they fit in really well with one commander, but then the next commander came in and they're struggling? Well, I would argue is they struggle to how to adjust. Okay, I got to adjust my communication style. I've got to ask different kinds of questions because I was assuming. I mean, we've lived a bunch of that, right? And so the non-commissioned officers that I've seen crush this, they're just like, man, what makes them so awesome? It's the ones that have the ability and emotional intelligence to adjust to the environment in which they just were moved into. And oh, by the way, in the joint world, it's even more important because the joint force is a little bit different than the Army. And so if you worked really well with a colonel in the Army, that may not be the case with a skipper in the Navy.
I'm sure too, like you've noticed, as you go up in rank, the relationships do matter.
Oh yeah.
You know, the officer that you may serve with in Afghanistan in 2019, maybe the chief of staff of the Army that you're working with in 2023. Yeah. I think that's one of the great things too, is as you move up, you know, everybody knows each other.
It is. And you know, the old Jim Collins level five, I think it is the level five. What's the secret sauce to the level five leader that everybody strives to be and wants more degrees and wants more stuff? I personally, Mike Weimer's personal opinion is it's the human space that takes, you know, because level four leaders are awesome and they're usually successful and they have all that. But what's that defined? What's that little bit of difference that makes the, I used to say, you work for that commander. You don't even know what the mission is. You don't care. You'd be filling sandbags. You just want to be on their team. You're like, I'm in. When are we leaving? You're like, well, do you want to hear what the mission? Nope. Whatever you're doing is going to have a purpose. You're going to take care of everybody. It's going to be righteous, whatever you're doing. I just want to be on your team, right? That's that level five leader that creates that culture and that environment. It's really not more education. It's really not more, you know, sheepskins hanging on the wall. It really is the human space, my opinion.
Yeah, and I want to ask that, like, what are some of the best practices you've seen with those level five leaders in your career? What are some of the things that, you know, you could pluck from that and just pass on, I don't know, like maybe in this podcast, yeah, to people listening that they could be like, okay, maybe I'm going to try that.
Well, I think, not to go down the op-psych route, but you know, I've spent a lot of my career with op-psychs available to have these candid conversations with. And I really enjoyed that over the years. The human space, I've spent a lot of time studying the human space because I think it is the defining factor of just a phenomenal leader versus somebody that can just drive to mission success all the time. I think there's a caring factor. So what I've noticed, and I don't mean like, well, empathy is a big part of it. Don't get me wrong. You have to be an empathetic leader. And I think the majority of the level five leaders we're probably envisioning in our mind, and anyone listening to this has probably already done that also. There's just something about they cared more than the average leader, right? And that creates follow through. That creates authenticity. I mean, all the buzzwords that we love to throw on a whiteboard with the word charts, it's really hard to fake that stuff if you legitimately don't care about building leaders and cultivating a healthy culture and following through, and, you know, people's, you know, families matter to you. And this to me is, you know, the difference between the cohesive team we never want to PCS away from and the okay team that, yeah, I'm good with leaving, but, you know, it wasn't terrible. I mean, that to me is the difference, that leader that just had a caring factor off the charts, right? Because we all get the same PME. Most of us study some, you know, if you look at all our degrees, you know, whether it's policy or national strategic stuff, I mean, they're all similar, right? All the education, whether it's civilian or military, is fairly similar. So what's that defining difference? To me, it's the person that has a very high caring factor for actually people and developing leaders.
Yeah. And I want to, you know, when I go back to some of the decisions I made of like where I'm going to serve, or mm-hmm, I can even think back, a leader asked me to come serve with him in Afghanistan. And,
yep,
you know, it was a very easy, you know, ask to go to my wife and say, hey, like, are you comfortable with me doing this? I'll be gone for a while.
Yeah.
But because this leader cared, and I think, you know, the other part of caring is not like letting somebody get away with everything. It's also holding people
not at all
accountable.
Yep.
Think back to like a recent sergeant major I had. I know he cared, and he also held me accountable.
Yeah.
And so, you know, whenever he started seeing me drift, he cared enough to say something to me about it. You know, to not let me fall below like what he thought I was capable of. And I think that's an important point too, because I think a lot of times, I know I did early on, right? I got care mixed up with people liking me. And, you know, if you really care about somebody, you'll hold them accountable.
Absolutely. That's the personal courage piece, right? Like, I care enough to have the personal courage to engage in an uncomfortable conversation, right? That's the, You know, how do you teach that? How do you, well, I personally think you have to model it. That's where your credibility comes, the authenticity comes, because I can give you, I can PowerPoint you to death, listen to this podcast, read this book, do all this. But if they're not seeing it in action, the art behind the uncomfortable conversation, when it's done well, it's because somebody actually cared. I mean, that's the, it's squishy, right? Which is why it's hard to replicate at scale. When you talk like a million person army, and you're trying to replicate this at scale for the perfect culture that we all want. We all know what right looks like. Why is it so hard? This very conversation we're having right now, that personal courage comes with time. And when we say, you know, Buck Sergeant Weimer and Staff Sergeant Weimer are on the forefront lines of cultivating the right culture and tending to it and all that, well, that personal courage we're talking about right now, that doesn't always just come through PME. It usually comes through life and modeled behavior from senior leaders.
Yeah, and you keep saying uncomfortable conversation. I think what's really important to know is that it's uncomfortable in the mind of the person having the conversation. But like, if I had a booger right now, it may be uncomfortable for you to call me out, say, hey man, you got a booger in your nose.
Yeah.
But I would be so grateful that you pointed that out, because that would be completely embarrassed if one day I get famous and we release this episode in video format and I've got a booger in my nose.
Well, in that case, we probably ought to pause. I got about four different things I need to tell you about right now, but no, I'm just kidding. I've said this for years. The sooner you become comfortable with the uncomfortable conversations, and really that's in your home, it's in your marriage, that's as a parent, that's as a leader at whatever echelon you are, and then you do it with empathy. Like you do it because you want to see the person get better. Oh my Lord, the whole equation just gets easier on your leadership journey, becoming, you know, a solid leader. But if you avoid the uncomfortable, the longer you avoid the uncomfortable, I think the harder it gets. And the next thing you know, you're the E8, 04, 05, E9 that gets held accountable for a culture now. Because right, that field grade level is when all of a sudden it's like, do you know this is your responsibility now? And you're like, whoa, okay. And then they're trying to go back and figure that out when they literally skipped 10 years of reps and sets. And all of a sudden you're like, well, this is easy. Yeah, I'll just take a walk with so-and-so and we'll just have this conversation at lunch and it's over. There's people I know would have an anxiety attack, you know, for certain subjects. And I'll be like, well, I'll talk to them. We'll just go for a walk. We'll just, meanwhile, they're, you know, having to do mindfulness training because their anxiety of approaching that subject with somebody. And I think that's because they delayed the process.
Yeah, and to double down on what you're saying, Sergeant Major, I used to be that person. I used to stress out on anything that was uncomfortable. But what I've learned over time is once you start doing it, it becomes way easier. But you got to do it.
You got to do it. And then the how we talk. I've shifted to spend a lot of time now in the army of the how you enforce standards, right? You either lose credibility with your soldiers, or it might not be your soldiers. It might just be somebody you see at the PX. But you either gain credibility as a leader or you lose credibility. Even if you're right, being right with this generation, it doesn't matter. It's how you engage them. It's critical.
It's funny you said this generation. I was that person. You were talking about like young Sergeant Weimer, Staff Sergeant Weimer coming up. Mm-hmm. I knew better than all my chain of command. If I would have just been in charge, everything would have been way better.
Of course it would have.
And I've learned I have so much more empathy now for people who are in charge. And I think you're absolutely right. The way I was as somebody who wasn't listening, it was very hard. And I think the one thing, going back to something earlier you said, that did make the difference, if I knew somebody cared about me and they called me out on something, I listened.
Yep.
If I thought they were just doing it to be an asshole because that's what they enjoy doing, no matter how much right they were, I would do the opposite.
Oh, yeah. Oh, 100%. You rage against the machine. believe me, I know. I have plenty of that in my career. I didn't have any respect for the leader. I potentially had seen the opposite behavior from that leader. So they had no credibility. So there's no respect. There's no credibility. You just rage. You rage against the machine at that point in time. So now the engagement, which could have been edifying, actually has the opposite effect. And you could potentially, that's a soldier you potentially lose to not, you know, reenlisting. And so that's why I think this is so, so important. And then if that's the soldier that doesn't reenlist and goes out, that feeds into a recruiting issue. And so that's why I'm so passionate about, especially E8s and E9s. I'm very passionate about the why it's important, but then the how you execute is our credibility.
I want to ask, you know, one of the two interviews I think I've heard you on the internet, you talk about standards and discipline.
Yeah,
quite a bit. And this is what I'm curious of, like, what does that look like to you? And the reason why, I've been in a bunch of different units mm-hmm. over the years. It's different in every unit. Every unit, I think, yeah. their definition of standards and their definition of discipline is different based on yeah. the location of the unit and the mission of the unit. So what does that look like for you?
Yeah, so I had to chuckle out loud for the folks that can't see us when you said, you know, I've heard you a couple times on the internet, because it's just, it's another one of those things that's just still strange to me. So forgive me, I wasn't laughing at you, I was laughing with you. So standards and discipline, well, first off, if they're not well-defined and they're not known, then I'm not even sure what we're talking about. And I'm finding that, and I'm receiving that feedback from around the Army, really, from the total Army, is that there's confusion, there's ambiguity, and again, you give Private Weimer some gray space and some ambiguity, Private Weimer is going to take advantage of it, right? I mean, that's, you know, that has nothing to do with this generation. I mean, that was, you know, that was the early 90s also. I'm sure it was in the 1980s. And so I think the first thing we have to do is for the Army is clearly ensure that the standards are known, and that there's the least amount of ambiguity possible. I think that's step one. And then you can actually get into how do you hold the standard? How do you ensure that the discipline comes from following the standards, reps and sets over time. You build personal discipline. It equals team cohesive discipline. It equals war fighting. I mean, that's the, you know, the long kind of version of why this matters is if I have no discipline as, you know, Sergeant Weimer in an infantry squad, then guess what? Then I'm a weak link in that infantry squad. And so if I can't get a haircut, I don't know how to wear my uniform, I can't, you know, pass the ACFT, I'm lazy today, I decide not to shave, or, you know, I'm one of these people where I can get away with it every other day because it doesn't really grow out. So every ounce of laziness, and we would say in our field, ounces equals pounds when you're moving over terrain with a rucksack. So you're trying to shed every ounce you can so that you go from carrying a 120-pound load to anything but 100 or less would be nice over time. I think it's the same thing with discipline. Every standard you compromise on is the sum of the ounces, right? And next thing you know, you're carrying around a 20-pound dumbbell of lack of standards. And if you do that with multiple people in a formation, you're carrying around all this excess weight that isn't mission essential or mission required to be successful. And that's why I'm really hard on this. I mean, you hear me, you probably also heard me say, you need to be brilliant at the basics. Well, I'll go back to, you got to define the basics for you. There's Army basics, I touched on a few, and then there's your MOS basics. And then you've got to train and hold yourself accountable to be brilliant at those. Well, we're never going to handle the complex in MDO and near peer adversary and the complexity of large scale combat operations. And so that's why I think it's the bedrock. And then it goes into the chief's focus area, which is really strengthening the profession, because standards and discipline is key to actually being a professional in an organization that believes, you know, we have a responsibility because we're an institution that's a professional institution. And so it's all connected. You've probably heard me say things, there's no such thing as a mundane task. As soon as you start chalking up, it's somebody else's job to take out the trash. It's not my job to change a tire. How many times did you go get a vehicle when it's empty? Oh, it's not my job to go back to the fuel yard and put fuel in it, even though I was the last person. All those things add up.
Yeah, I want to preface what I'm about to say with, again, 42 years old, made a ton of mistakes along the way. I'm still making mistakes every day. But the one thing that I've learned, especially when it comes to discipline, is that when you have a goal for yourself or the organization, you kind of have a vision to get there. Yeah. I think that's where discipline really comes in, because then you start cutting away all that excess stuff that doesn't matter, and you can really focus yeah. everybody. There's a a story that like I love, and I know it's not true, but it's really cool to just share, is one day the Pope came up to Michelangelo and he asked him, you know, hey, what's the secret to your genius? Like, how do you make all these great paintings and sculptures? And he specifically wanted to know how he created the masterpiece of David. And Michelangelo told him, he's like, it's very easy. I just cut away everything that's not David. And so, you know, in my own life, I know I have goals. Like I have fitness goals. I have, you know, professional development goals for myself. And so that makes me cut away all the things. Like I know if I drink late on a Saturday night, I'm not getting up and reflecting and writing on Sunday morning.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I'm not performing well at PT on Monday morning because I'm still nursing a hangover. And so I've noticed that once I've set those things for myself, I start cutting away all the excess stuff that kind of gets in the way of me trying to achieve that goal.
Yeah. And when you tie that, because some of that is the unspoken accountability piece. If you're really part of a cohesive team, right? Because you now don't want to let down your teammates. That's why the cohesive team piece is so doggone critical to this entire conversation, right? Because if I'm feeling lazy and don't want to do insert whatever it is, because we all have that thing, right? There's nobody that doesn't have the thing, including myself. But now when I go, but I don't want to let the team down, because we fight and win as a team. That's Team Weimer. That's my wife. That's me and my girls. That's us as a family. It's everything, right? And so I think the hard part to transition that to is when you have a formation of young soldiers that don't have the personal drive yet or haven't developed it. Or frankly, I mean, I still know adults that are in their 50s that never developed personal drive, right? But now you're responsible for leading them, because they're part of the team. And we don't all have a choice to just run selections and get rid of people. And there's just more coming in to fill the void, right? And so how do I lead them? This is the part of the joy of like when you see the Private Smith that's now Drill Sergeant Smith, who you knew when you met him 7 years ago, had no personal drive. And now they're teaching and coaching it and modeling it. And you were part of that journey, right? And so that's the transition I try to get people excited about, because you can't just cut those soldiers away in your formation and go, I'm not investing in you at all. No, they're critical to our warfighting mission. And so you have to figure that out. That's hard leadership.
I found too, I think there's like before me and there's current me. And before me, I'm just going to throw that away because that was a train wreck. Yeah. But yeah, like even the caring aspect, you know, when you talk to folks and find out what their goals are, showing that you care, and this isn't surface level, this is like actually caring.
Yeah.
And you start actually helping people try to achieve those. Yeah. Those are the people who are going to rise up.
Yeah.
And kind of in turn, help hold you accountable as well.
Yeah. There's caring because PME told you to care.
Yeah.
That's check the box caring. You know, that's like the, oh man, I got to do quarterly counseling. Let's just knock it out. And then there's the person that actually looks forward to quarterly counseling because they want to hear what we've worked on. They want to give you feedback. They want to hear what your goals are. I mean, those are just two completely different little scenarios there, right? And again, that's why it's like, you want to be that leader that everybody puts on a pedestal that I think we internally, intrinsically, we strive to be. You know, I would do a little self-reflecting on, you know, how much do I actually care? And really for me, it started at home. That was the pivot at home too. Cause I mean, like, how do you look yourself in the mirror and go, I don't care about my family? Well, jeepers creepers, of course I care about my family. So now I had to go, okay, well, how does the video match the statement that is like, no, of course I care for my family. And then you do that at the office also. And then you start changing some behaviors.
What were some of the tools that took you from, you know, Staff Sergeant Weimer, Sergeant Weimer, that probably pissed both of us off to like the Sergeant Major of the Army, you know, someone who's, you know, just seem a lot more grounded. I mean, I didn't know you back then, but you seem pretty grounded right now.
Well, I appreciate that vote of confidence. I'll take it. I'll take it and continue to build off of it. There's a lot of people that have invested in me. Back to what that photo is under the glass on my desk, where I can see it every day. By the way, the other photo is my family that's in the office. So Those two things keep me grounded, or try to keep me grounded, right? That's those personal disciplines that you build up over time to never forget where you came from, never forget the people invested in you, and then never forget, you know, whatever your current responsibility is right now. And this job, it's unfathomable, the responsibility this job has really for a total Army. It's humbling. But I will tell you, I had some leaders, I won't mention names, they don't want their names mentioned, but I was running hard and running in the red and not doing well. And I had a couple people, two in particular, I can see their faces right now, and I've communicated with both of them in the last 6 months, probably in the last year for sure, 6 months, one of them, even seen one of them in the last 4 months. Back in 2008, 2009, I was outrunning my headlights, and they had the uncomfortable conversation with me, you know, and I've never forgotten that. And so, you know, we have these seasons in our life. I had a lot going on at home. We had lots of losses over that last 3 years. I'd gotten tuned up and had to rebuild myself to get back in the fight. And my identity was tied in getting back into the fight. And that burden you kind of carry, again, back to that guilt, which is completely uncalled for. It's just something you put on yourself. And I had a couple people tell me, like, hey, you know, you're sorting yourself out, but you're not you anymore. You don't care like you did before. You're setting goals that are unattainable. Nobody can be this perfect leader, right? We strive for excellence. We don't strive for perfection, right? As soon as you strive for perfection, you're just setting yourself up for failure. You got to be a human being. You just got to own the things you screw up. Like, I got to have my office in here right now, and they tell you the last 6 months, and we'd laugh about some of the silliness. Because again, I'm still me, right? You don't get another rank and all of a sudden you stop being you. So I got to give credit to those two. And then my wife, who ultimately is committed to having the uncomfortable conversation with me when I'm not being myself. But you got to set that up. If you think, in this case, the Army is just going to give that to you and go, well, you had counseling every quarter, or somebody had to tell you you were headed down a path that wasn't good for you or the organization. I'm skeptical. That's not my experience. I had to build those relationships. And these were my seniors, but one was a peer and one was a superior. And I had to get that commitment. And so I do that now. Like, I've got people, I won't mention them now. We're doing every 6 months, I'm doing a check on learning, because they're out of the military and they're watching and observing. And I consider them mentors. And we're going to sit down and I'm going to get a report card as for what they're seeing. Because I need to have those trusted people around me. And so the more senior you become, and you do, I know you do this because I've listened to a podcast or two where you've talked about this, is like, you know, who are those people you can count on one hand that aren't afraid to tell you the truth, nothing but the truth, that you have to listen to, even if you don't like it. You can't ignore it because so-and-so means this much to you, or you have this, and you know, who are those people? And if you intentionally don't set those people up around you, man, I think you're setting yourself up for failure. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And so I would encourage people, establish those relationships early, reach out, be intentional with it. Don't wait for some ChatGPT AI thing to spit out who your mentor should be.
That's another great point. And that's, you know, something for me that I've come to recently as well. Is that, you know, you can read all you want, you can write all you want, you can reflect all you want, but if you don't have the accountability piece of it too, you can you can make up all sorts of stories to yourself. Justify.
They're usually great. They're usually great stories until they're not. Until they're not. Yeah.
Right. So it's awesome hearing that from you, and I've learned that with myself. If I don't have those people, I will be missing out. Well, I know our time is coming to a close, Sergeant Major.
Yeah.
Throughout this interview, you've talked a lot about self-development, personal development.
Yeah.
Are there any books that you've read along the way, or any tools or whatever?
Definitely.
That you use that have, again, gotten you to this point?
Yeah.
That you'd recommend right now?
Yeah. Man, it's funny how everyone always asks that. When you're addicted to learning, I'm a very inquisitive person, right? I got to give credit to my family who encouraged me along the way to just ask questions, read, and just, you know, be inquisitive. I call it being inquisitive. I don't know if that makes sense to everybody, but I can't help myself, right? You're not going to PowerPoint me to death in a brief. I'm asking questions. We're going to have a discussion because my time is the most valuable thing I have outside of my relationships, And so I want a dialogue, right? And so I will tell you, I've read, my wife and I have so many books. She's an avid reader on steroids. We didn't PCS them this last time. We actually put some in storage because the weight is insane. But we'll have a small library in our retirement home. I mean, like, I should say small, probably medium. So I've read a ton. I've read all the traditional. There isn't a Jim Collins book I haven't read. Gladwell, you know, there isn't one of those. You know, there isn't. I have every John Maxwell book. I've been fortunate over the years to have a relationship with the John Maxwell Corporation and done some really neat things with Chris Godey and some of the other coaches, Greg Cagle. But that's because I wanted it. Like, I sought that stuff out, right? And so, like, right now, I'm reading, was it Peak Mind? Just because I'm curious about, you know, mental aptitude. Army's throwing a few things at me. So I'm trying to make sure that my brain is working as well as my, you know, deadlift. Because I think right now people are a little more interested in my brain working than they are my deadlift, although I'm still trying to deadlift well. But, you know, Culture Code, a book that's near and dear to my heart. It's a little bit of a religious book. Spirituality is a big, big, big thing for myself and Team Weimer. But it's called Ordinary. If you want to remind yourself out of what being a humble, selfless servant is, that's a good one there. And then I'm big into the Stoics. I love the Stoics. I just can't help myself. I just do. Yeah. So Leading Change, that's a good one. If you're more of a senior leader, I think that's, what is that, Cotter?
Cotter, yep.
That's a good one. And then I got to give General McChrystal a shout out, because when he wrote Team of Teams, like 2015, 16, somewhere in there, it was literally like reading my 10 years of working for him in some form or fashion in the machine that was GWAT. I'm like, wow, this is words to what we were doing all those years to evolve, you know, really a whole nation process against the counterterrorism threat and an insurgency. So that's a handful. But I'll tell you the thing that I think makes that better, because you can read until you're blue in the face and you're going to remember, and you don't remember anything. It's journaling. I write things down. I'm very visual anyway. And so I always encourage people, and the younger the group, the more I kind of really encourage them, is like, write things down. Reflection time with writing down. Yes, I drive in the car and I reflect and all that, but the intentionality piece is like, write that question down and just chew on it by yourself. It's almost like the journal becomes the other person that's not in the room with you. And then that, back to that group of people you can trust with anything, you can take that, you can actually have a conversation with the trusted circle. There's magic in that.
All right, just a couple of things. So one, I got a book recommendation a month ago from the Command Sergeant Major of No Slack in the 101st. It's called What You Do Is Who You Are by Ben Horowitz.
Yep.
Basically, the premise of the book is, it doesn't matter what you say. Doesn't matter your culture statement. Doesn't matter any of that stuff. It's what you do is what it boils down to. And so anyways, he texted it to me one day and I read it. I listened to it. And then I just bought like a physical copy to hit it again. I absolutely love it. And then your point on journaling, we talk a lot of times about resiliency.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you've been the same way, but it's really fun to go back. If you're writing stuff down, the stuff you're thinking about, the stuff you're wrestling with, and then a year from now, you go back and look, you're like, oh man, at the time, I didn't think I was going to make it through this. Or, you know, I was like, how the hell am I going to do this?
Yeah.
And then, you know, now you're like, oh wow, like that was easier. This is how I solved that. And, you know, it builds you confidence, builds resiliency. So I really appreciate you saying that, both of those things, reading and reflecting and journaling on the podcast.
No, it's huge. And, you know, I got to have General Donahue. We got a lot of time with General Donahue, as you know. And he's the first one I heard say this, but I believe it in my heart of hearts, man. Culture is what you do every day, and especially when people aren't looking. It really is. So I'm intrigued by the book, No Slack 9, gave you. So I'm going to definitely check that one out.
All right. Well, Sergeant Major, thank you so much. This was awesome. Every time I think we've seen each other in the past, it's been a high five somewhere, a handshake, and then we both went in opposite directions. So this is time well spent. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. And again, forgive me for taking so long, but man, I knew I would enjoy this and you didn't disappoint. I'm really excited for what you have coming up in the future, however you announce all that stuff. I'm excited for it. I really appreciate what you're doing. There's a lot of people doing this in the space you're in, but not everybody's doing it as well as you are.
Well, thanks, Sergeant Major. And I have to say, I have an amazing team of volunteers from across the Army and the Navy now that are
awesome.
Helping make this happen.
Join.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for your time, Sergeant Major. Thank you again for listening to another episode of From the Green Notebook podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please give us 5 stars wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps us gain visibility and the opportunity to help more people on their leadership journey. Also, make sure you check out our website at www.fromthegreennotebook.com. There, you can listen to past episodes, read leadership articles written by military leaders from around the world. You can sign up for our monthly reading list email where you can learn about new books that are coming out, and our Sunday reflection email that comes out every Sunday morning. Is really short. It's a 2-minute read, but I guarantee you it's going to start your week off on the right foot. Finally, make sure you follow us on Twitter at FTGNNotebook, and you can find us on Instagram and Facebook by searching for From the Green Notebook. Again, thank you so much for coming on this journey with us. I am humbled by the opportunity to learn these lessons alongside you. So please join us next week for another episode of From the Green Notebook, where we're going to help you lead with the best version of yourself. I came from the mud. There's dirt on my hands. Strong like a tree. There's roots where I stand. Oh, I've been running from the law.